It is Let's Get Legal, 720 WGN. It is Dane in for John Hansen. The whole thing powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. And excited to have on the line for our next guest, the criminal defense attorney trial lawyer, Michael Leonard of Leonard Trial Lawyers. Michael, welcome to WGN.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's weird not hearing John's voice. Do you think he's listening?
I'm sure he is. He's totally listening. He's been texting, like, make sure to say this, you know, make sure to, you know, like, just extol the accolades of Michael Leonard. Just that's what he said mostly, you know. So we're going to definitely
Should we roast John in some fashion since he's listening?
Ooh, I don't know if he's roastable. He's an easygoing guy with a good sense of humor. It's tough, right? Because
that's
he's
true. He's such a wonderful guy. Yeah,
he is wonderful, right? And then at the Blackhawks games, he's super goofy, right? So he doesn't take himself too seriously. Yeah, I don't know. We'll give it thought. Maybe at the end of this segment, just, you know, keep that on the back burner and we'll think of something kind of roasty, right?
Yeah, we'll come up with some. I got to give a shout out to a first time listener I met today, Norberto, listening for the first time. So I wanted to throw that in there if I could.
Is Norberto a defendant in a case that you're managing and you're trying to, like, listen how smart I am?
He could be, you know.
One of the topics that did get set in is the Supreme Court on Wednesday rejected President Trump's emergency request to freeze nearly $2 billion in foreign aid in a closely divided decision. So what are your thoughts on this? Because there are so many things that are happening so fast and so kind of furious here, and I don't know that the implications, especially when it comes to our position on the foreign aid side or the ability for those people that would benefit to make alternate plans. You know, it just seems like it's happening so fast and a lot of damage is taking place, but a positive sign, I think, right, where we're at least saying, hey, let's take a look at this.
Yeah, this one's a little bit of a saga, so you kind of have to step back a month or so, where Trump issued an executive order saying that he's going to freeze all foreign aid assistance payments, and that caused all the sorts of contractors, agencies, et cetera, to go to court, and they got a ruling from a judge in the D.C. Circuit in Washington saying, hey, hold on, I'm going to grant a TRO, essentially meaning that you can't stop those payments. And then the Trump administration essentially violated the order, refused to comply, and that district court judge said, hey, look, you got to pay by, you know, a date certain at midnight, and they still didn't pay. But what they did is they ran to the U.S. Supreme Court, and everyone thought, gee, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to go with the Trump administration and, you know, essentially let them do what they want with the executive order. And the Supreme Court initially said, okay, well, we're going to stay the district court's decision. So basically that put that on hold. However, to everyone's surprise, this past week, the U.S. Supreme Court came back and said, okay, hold on, we're not upholding, you know, the executive order, but we are sending it back to the district court judge to sort of clarify what he means. And so a lot of people thought that was great because he wasn't upholding executive order, but some were saying, well, what are they doing? You know, they're sending it back to the district court. And interestingly enough, the district court very quickly said, I meant what I said. What I meant was that you need to pay all these outstanding invoices, money that's already been appropriated and most of it's been spent. You got to pay that now. And so curiously, they didn't run back to the Supreme Court right away. They started paying. So I think a lot of people are heartened by this kind of turn of events.
So Michael, is there something that we can sort of do, because there's been so many, whether it's sort of backtracking on some of the DOGE stuff, whether it's firing people and deciding, oh, they're manning the nuclear stockpile, we should have them back, that there should maybe be a process in place where maybe the administration, and maybe it'd be an expedited court case so they get through it as quick as possible, but maybe they put in a request to freeze or request to fire, and then people will look, number one, if it's legal, and then number two, if it's a good idea, because you're seeing media stories now of some of this foreign aid, you know, and just the higher purpose that's built into it, just the people that will be absolutely devastated, potentially fatally, if they don't get some of this aid. And you think, well, you should think this through.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point and a great example, because, you know, as they showed, when they put the freeze on, you had people who were already performing under contracts. So you had food sitting in warehouses that need to be delivered. You had services already provided, and it was simply paying their invoice. So, you know, it'd be kind of like in a private setting, if you entered a contract with another party and someone else said, oh, hold on, no one needs to pay those bills, even though you've already performed. So it does create, you know, sort of a sense of havoc. And I think you're right. You know, when you're issuing a flurry of executive orders, one after the other, and then kind of depending upon the fact that the courts are going to take months or longer
right.
to sort this out, that does really create a chaotic situation for all sorts of players.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of those situations when we come back from this break with Michael Leonard. It's Let's Get Legal here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it is Let's Get Legal. It is Dane in for John Hanson, the whole thing powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, and continuing our conversation with celebrated criminal defense attorney and acclaimed trial lawyer, Michael Leonard of Leonard Trial Lawyers. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Any input from John during the break?
No, he hasn't. I'm sure he's waiting. He doesn't want to add any fuel to the fire. But if we need him, I'm sure he would give, like, hey, roast me on this. You know, I don't know. Maybe he would.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Maybe he would do that. I wanted to ask you, and you mentioned, you know, just the whole, the legal experience can be protracted and take a long time. And all the while, because of the nature of the aid and the services, that people's lives are hanging in the balance. It's one thing to go to court to try to stop what's happening or try to free up the funds or try to keep things moving. But if they don't, you know, then bad things happen, whether it's businesses that are impacted or fail, or whether it's people that die because of the nature of the aid. Your thoughts on this as far as liability, right? If someone is supposed to get something and let's say it's the administration or someone in there that is causing this disruption that ends up contributing to, you know, someone's death or maybe in like an entire population of death, where does the liability fall?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, the problem with government funds is, you know, and the release of them is, you know, the immunity issue. So it's very difficult to sue a federal government over some issue like this. But that's essentially what started all this, you know, all those agencies and contractors bringing suit, because at its core, it's really a basic thing. It's really a breach of contract theory. Hey, you said you were going to pay me if I provided these services or these foodstuffs, or I provided, you know, this aid or whatever. And, you know, we're entitled to be paid under that contract, which is just kind of how private disputes would go as well. So I think you still have the chance to hold the government accountable for a breach of contract theory. But all those other horrible consequences you talk about, the collateral consequences of not funding and not providing the services where people die, you know, people are probably without relief in terms of the legal system.
Do you feel like that, you know, with everybody knowing everything, information is so readily available that the legal community, the court community can see this for what it is and deal with it as really a philosophy, a theory, a game plan, you know, the whole flood the zone or move fast, break things, and that it's designed to overtake the capabilities and responsiveness of the court system, and that maybe instead of dealing with things on an individual basis, which of course they have to, right, because they're individual cases, but look at it as more of an overarching thing where the entire process is designed to make these court cases sort of unable to be responsive and to kind of handle these issues. I mean, I think that's part of the game plan, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, what would be the most helpful probably to everybody, including all branches of government, if the Supreme Court did take up one of these cases and sort of decided the contours of what is the president's authority under executive order, you know, how much authority does he have? Because that's really what it comes down to. All these executive orders then create sort of legal chaos, and there hasn't been an overarching decision from the Supreme Court as to what are the parameters of that power, because it really brings up all sorts of issues, you know, balance of powers between the executive, legislative, basic things like what we're talking about before, breach of contract. But I don't think that's going to happen because, you know, our system really isn't designed to be built that way. And courts, including the Supreme Court, only take up a specific controversy that's before it, you know, rather than a theoretical or hypothetical situation. And that's what aids the administration here.
Yeah.
Because they do know that it's going to take a long time in the district court. They might get an appellate court that's friendly to them, depending upon, you know, the political motivations of that appellate court. Then ultimately, you know, the fact that it may take months to get a Supreme Court ruling, and they're sort of counting on that.
Does the court, and I know they deal with things individually in those court cases, but everybody knows in the legal world that precedence is that that decision will be applied to so many other things that will influence things going forward. Do they ever, or would they ever, and maybe it would be groundbreaking, be proactive in the thought process when it comes to something like this?
It would be great. Yeah, I mean, if you had a case that's head on, that kind of addresses the issue of the balance of powers and whether an executive order can essentially overrule an act of Congress, which is, I think, what we're talking about, then at least you'd provide some framework. And then if it was violated, those principles were violated, maybe you could readily go to court and get a decision based upon that Supreme Court precedent. So unfortunately, we seem right now, you know, far away from that sort of relief happening, which does, again, make the most from a common sense standpoint, but that's not probably what's going to happen in the courts.
Well, we'll see how it all plays out. Iridian mentioned that you're the kind of guy that you can just say, hey, are there other stories that are legal stories in the news that are happening that you're either excited about or think the listeners would want to hear about?
Well, we're in a little bit of a lull in terms of the high-profile Chicago trials. You know, post-Madigan, I feel like there's a media lull, that's for sure. I've just been busy getting ready for some upcoming federal trials, so that's why I've been kind of focused on that. And then focused on being in court, trying to argue, you know, detention hearings on behalf of various clients. But I'm mostly focused on my upcoming trials in the next few months.
Well, I wanted to ask you then, too, early on before the show, we talked about some of, you know, you guys are guests in position of authority when it comes to the subject matter. And so we had wondered with all of the shows and whether it's the popularity of the podcast or true crime shows or a lot of the legal shows that have always been popular, going back to maybe Perry Mason or things like that, is like what inspires people to get involved and choose those careers that they take to a level where, you know, they're on a show like this sharing their opinions and their thoughts. So for you, Michael, like, what was it? Was there a young Michael sitting, you know, watching TV, watching Perry Mason, or maybe it was Law and Order, SV? I don't know exactly how old you are, where you said, I want to do that.
Yeah, you know, I'm still a very young man of 59. But, yeah, it's a great question, because I think there are people who, you know, from that early age go, I want to be a lawyer. You know, and I think that it was something always in the back of my mind. I didn't really come from a long line of lawyers in the family. My grandfather was in the state of Wisconsin. I always thought that was pretty cool, but I was very young and never got that opportunity to talk to him. But I did always love to sort of argue points, and maybe from my family standpoint, endlessly. So it was really not until my mid-college years where I said, that's what I'm going to do. I want to go to law school. I want to try cases. I thought that was the most exciting thing, just from seeing on TV and movies, trying cases. And that's kind of always been my focus from the time I decided to go to law school, through law school, and really through my entire career.
Yeah, not all attorneys are created equal as far as the work that they do. My brother-in-law is a contract attorney. He'd be the first to tell you it's pretty boring. You know, you're not objecting. You're not doing any of those things. Well, we talked about some of the things that are out there, the true crime shows. And on the, you know, I'll watch on the YouTube those interrogation and confession, you know, where they have the actual footage and people are saying that, just like a sports fan would say, like, hey, we can't run the ball again, or don't throw that interception. Do you ever find yourself watching those as a defense attorney saying, don't say that, or here's what I would do, you know, where you're thinking like, oh man, this guy, he's just not being represented?
Oh yeah, I mean, especially the interrogation tapes are tough to watch, because so often people are there unrepresented, meaning they don't have counsel at all, and for whatever reason they choose to sit there and answer questions, and some people might think that's laudable. But you can also see in those interrogations where, you know, things start to turn, you know, where they're under such intensity and scrutiny for so long that you can start to see them break. You're like, oh no, here's where it's going to go. But yeah, I mean, because I can relate readily, because I see those types of tapes in my own cases, and you can kind of see where it goes the wrong direction for your client.
Let the listeners know we're talking with Michael Leonard of Leonard Trial Lawyers. I had always wondered, so it's a luxury to be able to ask you this question. For those interrogations, when they say that the guy's been in there for, you know, 17 hours when he started, like, I don't know anything. And then how do you get 17 hours out of that? Like, wouldn't you be like, hey, can we wrap this up? I mean, how does it work where they extend it so long? And we've all heard that story about the guy that confessed to killing his dad, and his dad was absolutely fine. I mean, it goes sideways sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole problem, the much-heralded false confessions, because they do happen, and they happen more often than we think. And the average layperson says, gee, I would never, ever confess to something I didn't do. But oftentimes we're talking about people who are younger, people who might not have full mental capacities, people can be kind of manipulated. And there are no hard and fast rules about how long and how you can interrogate somebody. I mean, we've gotten lucky in terms of states like Illinois, which require certain interrogations to now be videotaped and audio taped, and is a huge advantage. But, you know, you take breaks. What law enforcement does, if the person's not asking for counsel, they'll take breaks. They'll come at them again. They'll come at them with stuff that often is absolutely untrue or lies. And as you can imagine, over when you're sleep deprived and you're under intense scrutiny, you're told things that absolutely are not true. They're false statements about your involvement. You can see why, you know, some people might fall prey to that. Other people would say, gee, I would never do that. But certainly they've never been put in that position.
Yeah, I mean, you would say I would never agree to that. But if you think some of the principles, and of course, you know, 99% of our law enforcement people are out there trying to catch the bad guys and do the right thing. And but for some of them, it seems like it's almost, you know, interrogation, like torture techniques, right? You're trying to make people tired. You're trying to confuse them. You're trying to get them to say things that maybe that even the law enforcement people know, or maybe have their own doubts that they should be doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends, you know, on their training, what's sort of expected or allowed in their particular district or county or venue, and, you know, kind of going back to their experience, maybe even going back to the police academy. But you can't forget the fact that also they oftentimes, you know, they truly believe this person has done what they think they're accused of, right? So they're not acting necessarily with ill motive. They actually believe that this person has done it. And they're just believing, they're hell-bent on the idea that I got to get him to say something that I already know to be true, even if it's not. So it's an imperfect system because, you know, there's human beings on all sides of this.
You got to get the best advice you can. Michael Leonard, Leonard Trial Lawyers. For people who want to get more information or get in touch with you, well, where can they go?
312-380-6559, LeonardTrialLawyers.com. Really appreciate having me on.
Well, very last thing, what was your favorite all-time lawyer, you know, like television show? What was your favorite show? Which one's the most real that you liked?
It's a tough one. You got me stumped because I haven't had a chance to think about it. My Cousin Vinny is just a classic, so I always kind of come back to that. But I did just watch, there's one right out right now, called Anatomy of a Scandal. It's set in like London. Loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And the newish OJ documentary. You're probably tired of OJ, but I thought that one was really well done as well. But I'm an endless junkie for law shows and law movies, so I'm probably not a good person to ask because I like them all.
Michael Leonard, great representation, movie reviews. He's got it all. Thanks again for jumping on the show.
Hey, appreciate it. Have a good rest of the show. Hats off to John and Enrique.